In our divided nation, too many media voices have retreated into their partisan echo chambers. It's either red meat or safe spaces. Where are critical thinkers to go? Well, you've got a home right here on the Charles Love Show. Charles understands the problems we face and will show they are rooted in culture. Prepare to be educated and enlightened with an emphasis on common sense, context, and the quest for logical perspectives. Now, here's your host, Charles Love.
Welcome to the show. My guest this week is Matt Rosenberg. He is a journalist, writes for City Journal and JohnCast.com, and author of a new book, What Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son. We talked about all things Chicago in our conversation, and we start off by discussing why he wrote the book and what made him come back to the streets of Chicago. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Charles. I'm really pleased to be with you today.
Well, I'm really looking forward to this. A nice long conversation about the ins and outs of Chicago. And you approach this a little uniquely in the sense that you've been in Seattle, for several years. So I want to start by asking what made you want to write a book about Chicago?
You bet. Well, Charles, I lived here for 30 years. It was a very formative period of my life, considering I was about, 5 or 6 years old when I moved to Chicago in the year of 1964, didn't leave till about 94 when I was in my middle 30s, by which time, of course, I'd started my career and gotten married. But I came back because in 2020, I saw so much happening. Who did not, right? In Chicago and all of our big cities after George Floyd's heinous death at the hands of police in Minneapolis, Chicago descended into violent chaos. And this is a city that I loved, had many fond memories of, had many good friends still living here. And I felt like I had to dig deeper. So I came back and I moved into Bridgeport, as you know, the ancestral home of the Irish political mob, if you will. Moved into Bridgeport and started going deep into the South Side to talk to people about their lives, their success stories, their challenges, and what the heck was going on and how to fix things, if at all.
So you came from Chicago, Seattle. I keep saying Chicago, but we are going to obviously spend most of our time talking about Chicago. But in that mad year of 2020, Seattle had a few, let's just say, issues as well. So can you talk a bit about any similarities and differences you saw between Chicago and Seattle, simply just 2020, like the madness that was going on after that?
Absolutely. Seattle, you know, and Portland and a number of West Coast cities all were really off the chain in 2020. Seattle, of course, probably the landmark event was when activists successfully pressured the mayor to actually give up one of the city's five police precincts. We only have five of them there. And the mayor said, sure, we will shut it down and give you the neighborhood. And she said, and this is a tough, common sense, no nonsense, centrist Democrat named Jenny Durkin. That was our mayor then. She had been U.S. attorney for Western Washington under President Barack Obama. She was no pushover. Let me put it that way. And yet she folded her hand very fast to the Antifa types who wanted to take over the police station, because police had been determined to be all of a sudden, irresolutely evil. And so it was important to shut down a police station and take over the neighborhood around it. She said yes. And so this area was called the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. And the mayor said, it will be nice, probably like the summer of love in San Francisco. It turned out to be a complete flaming cartwheeling train wreck. But what you saw in Seattle, and this was just part of what happened, was the same thing we saw in Chicago and other cities. We saw bold challenges to authority and to law and order, and we saw the people in charge folding their hand fast. In Chicago, the outcomes were much more deadly. We did have people die in the Capitol Hill autonomous zone because police could not get through and there was violent crime going on. So there was a cost in lives in Seattle, but the cost in lives was much greater in Chicago to this ceding of authority, this giveaway of power and control over the streets.
Right. So, yeah, I wanted to point that out because that was really crazy and made national news. So you really got it on both ends. But we are obviously here to talk about your wonderful book on Chicago. And the book is called What Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son. So I have to start by asking, as we get into the book, why are you pissed off?
People have asked me that. I'm pissed off because police have been vilified and the entire environment here now is such that police can barely even do their jobs. They have largely given up and ride around in their squad cars, answering one 911 call after another. If they exercise initiative, undertake a foot chase, they'll probably be breaking new rules. If they return fire, they'll probably be declared to be racist. So I'm pissed off about the environment that we've created for policing. I'm quite pissed off about our local court system under Chief Judge Timothy Evans of Cook County and State's Attorney Kim Fox of Cook County. There is virtually almost no violent criminal that won't catch an easy break in this system. And so we have, carjackers, gun law violators being sent right back out after they're charged. And all too often, they do more of the same and graduate too often to even more severe crimes, up to and including murder. I'm aghast at the flash mob armed robbery crews. Just when we were getting used to the organized looting crews, which are bringing guns into downtown stores in our formerly tourist-friendly shopping area known as the Magnificent Mile or Michigan Avenue. Just when we got used to the organized looting crews going into suburban malls now, bearing guns, wreaking havoc, leaving shoppers cowering under counters in fear. Just when we had gotten used to all of that, then something new came along. It was a chauffeured armed robbery crews who organized sometimes through Twitter hashtag, hence flash mob armed robbery crews, just popping out of vehicles on the streets of Chicago and relieving people at gunpoint of their packages, backpacks, phones and wallets. So I'm kind of pissed off about the way that law and order has broken down in this city. And I'm pissed off at the racialism that is behind it. Nobody who is of color. And as you know, a great, great percentage and majority of the offenders are of color. No one who is of color can be held to the same standard as say a white person. There is this collective guilt, this white guilt, as Shelby Steele has called it, that is endemic in the land. It's the same reason that we don't want to hold our public school system accountable. That's another thing I'm pissed off about. We have fewer than one out of five of Black fourth graders and eighth graders who can reach even the basic proficiency standard in math and English in Chicago public schools on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the nation's report card. And yet, you know, the city accents that there's an 81% graduation rate from high school. Well, performance on the SATs is no better than on the NAEP. So I'm pissed off at failing institutions, including failing families, and how that's not allowed to be discussed either. So there's quite a lot to be pissed off about here. And I think so long as you can propose solutions, which of course I do in the book, and so long as you can talk about success stories, then it's okay to be pissed off if that's a bridge to working toward the progress that we must make in this city.
Coming up, more with Matt Rosenberg, journalist, writer, and author of What Next Chicago. You're listening to The Charles Love Show on AM 560, The Answer.
We return to The Charles Love Show on AM 560, The Answer. Once again, here's Charles Love.
Are you tired of summer nights in Maine?
Welcome back. I am continuing my conversation with Matt Rosenberg, author of What's Next Chicago. And here we kind of get into what makes Chicago so infamous. We start off by talking about whose policies and decisions have caused a rise in crime. But we go into a little history of Chicago, the politics, the racism, the patronage and things of that nature. And he points out 4 points that he believes are the keys to the failures that Chicago has seen.
That sometimes gets overlooked in the national media. I think Kim Fox, the prosecutor, is responsible for dropping lots of prosecutions, lousy plea deals, which is a whole nother thing. But it's important also to identify the chief judge, who is the architect of bail reform, quote unquote. It is Chief Judge Tim Evans. So both he and prosecutor Kim Fox, in their different ways, have contributed to the breakdown of the law. And that in turn contributes to a breakdown in order.
And that's important if you're talking about solutions. You can say what you want about the mayor, but I said this didn't start with Lori. My point was didn't start with Lori. It happened under Rahm. We haven't Republicans in years. We can say all that, but you can have the most right-wing mayor. They can fix some things. I mean, they can bring more confidence in the police department if you're really pro-police. I mean, there's some things you can do without a doubt, but you're not touching the bigger problem if you're not doing anything about that. So that's what I think people need to understand, and you point that out. Now, another thing about your book is the way you lay it out. So you talk a bit about the 2020, like we discussed, and how things were bad. You watched it from Seattle. You came here and you wanted to kind of report on it. You started writing. But what I like about it is, you know, I kind of in the know and been close to Chicago my whole life. I grew up in Gary, Indiana. But a lot of people just hear certain things about corrupt elections and politicians, but they don't go delve deep into it. And the next part of the book kind of takes you through, you know, a brief history of Chicago, how we got here. So talk about that, how you talked about the communities, how they came to be, you know, kind of be framed the way they are, the way the politicians used to be. Everybody knows about the Democrat machine, but how that machine kind of calcified. And you talk about racism because racism was and is an issue. So you don't ignore that. You talk about how that plays a part. So talk a bit about, you know, the political history of Chicago.
Sure. You know, the Irish, the Italians, and then later the Polish ran the show for quite a long time in politics and in the construction trade unions. And it really affected things. I mean, starting with the Great Migration, of course, of Blacks from the South, you know, by the early 20th century, there was a formidable Black community in Chicago. It was very segregated. And as the decades passed and the first really modern mayor of Chicago came to power, Richard J. Daley, the boss, as he was called, Blacks were geographically really kept in a box in an area now called Bronzeville. Eventually, they began to spread across the South and West sides, but the city has always been very segregated. The construction of high-rise housing projects, as in other cities, was perhaps incredibly, thought to be a smart and progressive strategy. It turned out, obviously, to be very harmful. The way that expressways were routed and built, particularly the rerouting by Mayor Daley of the Dan Ryan Expressway, I-94, served as a geographic divider between the Black South Side and white areas like Bridgeport, where all the Irish politicians and fixers lived. You know, there was a dramatically disparate allocation of resources. For instance, the parks in Black neighborhoods were, given scant resources and maintenance. They were run down and brown, not green. The parks in white areas, you know, were lavished with manpower and extra equipment and facilities. You could find an awful lot of actual institutional racism in Chicago, you know, if you looked right up into the 1980s. A lot started to change when Harold Washington was elected the city's first Black mayor in 1983. But even then, you know, over time, part of what I describe is that as the Latinos and the Blacks came more into political power in Chicago, rather than elevate really the needs of their constituents on a consistent basis, they instead emulated the old school white ethnic politicians. And it became a case of what can I get my hands on, right? You know, how can I carve out a kickback from this contract directed to that vendor? And it was the same, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. So that's part of what went on. But there were some epic struggles, like especially after Mayor Washington died. And there's some things I describe in the book, you know, that are known to people who follow the political history of this place. There was some ugly internecine warfare within the Black political community over who would replace Harold Washington when he died shortly after he was reelected to a second term. And that in turn paved the way for the election of Mayor Daley the second. And that was a very important period through the 90s and the aughts, where really this sort of, you know, second chapter of Chicago corruption became institutionalized and, you know, ways became very set. And that led into the years of Rahm Emanuel, 2011 to 2019, and then the election of Lori Lightfoot in 2019. But a lot has been calcified here. I think there are four factors that have sort of set the course in Chicago, and I'll spell them out quickly and then turn it back over to you, Charles. I think number one, there's been this sort of strident leftism, which assumes no agency among Blacks, no ability for Blacks to take care of themselves. It assumes that they're victims, that if outcomes are poor, that it's because of racism. Nothing can be discussed, particularly issues around family solidarity, the role of parents in educational readiness, the role of parents in, keeping young men and boys on a straight and narrow path, meaning avoiding the lure of gangs on the street and avoiding a life of crime. Nothing can be discussed because of this strident leftism. Number two, there's glaring incompetence in governance. Things just don't work, from the schools to the city finances to more. Then there's ambition, which means that political power is used for its own end, not for the greater good, but so politicians can hold and build power, period. And then finally, related to that, you have corruption and rigged rules of governance, which really has helped to define things here. So all of those things combine, and running through the middle of it is sort of a deep embarrassment at the failure of great society programs. We've had liberal progressive Democrats running Chicago for, you know, at least 60 years. The last Republican mayor was in 1931. It's a one-party state, and a one-party town. And there's really a deep embarrassment that all of these spending programs and social programs have failed to turn things around, but nobody wants to look at the evidence. It's just we need more, more, more. And so it's very hard to talk about individual responsibility here. And right now, in 2022, especially with a horrendous 2021 in the rearview mirror, a year when 800 people were murdered in Chicago, carjackings went through the roof, academic achievement was hurt again by COVID and the decision to close schools and rely on really fairly horrible remote learning. With all of that in the rearview mirror, you know, it seems that these issues of family solidarity, individual will and determination and agency loom larger than ever. So in other words, these controlling factors that have added to the city's troubles over recent decades are as relevant as ever, if not more so.
Coming up, more with Matt Rosenberg, author of What Next Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son. You're listening to The Charles Love Show on AM 560, The Answer.
You're listening to The Charles Love Show on AM 560, The Answer, with your host, Charles Love.
Welcome back. I am continuing my conversation with Matt Rosenberg, author of What Next Chicago? And a very important part of Chicago, what makes it, you know, Chicago, is its neighborhoods. So Matt writes a lot about the neighborhoods, specifically targeting South and West Side neighborhoods, and why he thought that was important to telling the story of Chicago. And he opens this segment by talking about Bridgeport, where he was staying, and the interesting things he saw and discussed before he even got to the South and West Side neighborhoods.
I moved into the ancestral Irish stomping grounds in Chicago. Bridgeport, I think, was first called Hardscrabble in 1836. A lot of other immigrant groups settled there besides the Irish, but it became known as the hotbed of Irish social and political activity. And it's from where five different mayors of Chicago, all Irish, have come, including the two Daleys. So I figured, okay, here it is, 2020. The city's blowing up. I need to be getting down into the South Side. Where should I park myself and maybe get some flavor and some further understanding of this city's history? And it just seemed like Bridgeport was the place to go. So I did that, and it was illuminating.
Right. It's funny you say that, because you also talked about an interesting interaction you had with a police officer there at a Catholic church, I believe. Talk about that and tell us what happened with that.
Yeah. You know, you see the strangest things if you just keep your eyes and ears open. So this was in November of 2020. And, you know, Chicago was blowing up. There were, I think that week, early in the month, 77 shootings, I don't know, 15, 20 killed. But here I am staying on Carpenter Avenue, south of 32nd Place. There's a big, beautiful church there called St. Mary of Eternal Help, if I'm remembering the name right. And one day I come out, it's the day after Joe Biden has been declared the winner in the presidential election. And I see a lot of police activity behind the church. I take a closer look, and it's been spray painted with anti-religious graffiti and anarchist symbols, and even Joe Biden's name on the back wall of the church. And an alabaster white statue of St. Mary has been desecrated too. And I was, you know, a little bit flabbergasted, and I noticed a police car parked on an angle as if to protect the church. And I see what's happened, and I go up and I'm talking to the police officer from his car, and we kept talking, and I guess he wanted to commiserate. So he hops out and he tells me, you know, I was baptized in this church. After all it's done for the community, now this. And I'm thinking, yeah, boy, I feel you. So I go on my way, do my grocery shopping, come back 50 minutes later, all the graffiti is gone. And there's no one there anymore except a young parishioner, his wife, and their baby in a stroller. And I just look at the guy and I say, that was quick. And he looks back at me and he says, yeah, we took care of it. No TV cameras. You know, this came on the heels of a lot of other stuff that I saw in the city and in Bridgeport. And, you know, there'd been a shooting on my block. I'd also witnessed a weird scene just a half a block away in Bridgeport, where this sort of toothless 60-year-old guy with a mullet is standing in front of an art gallery that has an exhibit, two exhibits. One is about Black queer identity. The other is some blown up photographs of protests in the 80s with protesters carrying big signs that said, F the president, right? And so here's this toothless 60-year-old guy with a mullet who tells me he grew up in Bridgeport and he's got no use for Black people or gays. And I'm like, ooh, man, okay, time to do some actual anti-racism work, right? Because conservatives do that too. So I start talking to the guy. You know, I try the Socratic method. I try the head-on approach. Mm-hmm. None of it's working. This guy's no, uh-uh. And I just sort of chalked that one up to experience. But so after all of that stuff has happened, then I come across this church desecration the day after the election. And I'm just thinking, whoo, you know, and there's been a shooting, too, on my block a few days before. I'm sitting there at 9 in the evening and I hear bullets flying. And I verify that the next day with some cops who are out on the street investigating. So it wasn't firecrackers. And so I'm adding it all up. And I'm thinking, okay, here I am back in my hometown where I lived for 30 years, from 64 to 94. And as I mentioned, I've always come back. I've never really left Chicago. And I'm just adding it all up. I'm adding up the body count and the count of shootings this week. And looking at this church desecration at this old white racist still in Bridgeport, And this is a hip happening neighborhood. And I'm thinking, yeah, this city really is in a tough way. It seems like if we don't make some, I call them crux moves, after a phrase that's used by hikers out in the Pacific Northwest, where I've lived for a while. If we don't make some crux moves in this decade, Chicago was really in trouble. So I had kind of an epiphany moment there in Bridgeport. And it still sticks with me.
Coming up, more with Matt Rosenberg, author of What Next Chicago. You're listening to The Charles Love Show on AM 560, The Answer.
Now, more of The Charles Love Show on AM 560, The Answer, with your host, Charles Love.
Welcome back. I am talking with Matt Rosenberg, author of What Next Chicago, about what he experienced in Chicago when he came back to investigate the problems that he saw from his home in Seattle. And here I ask him about his approach and the way he wrote the book. And he talks about his process and kind of gives us a little insight into his childhood in Chicago, and then goes into the neighborhoods that he visited and the people that he met.
You know, I guess I was trained in shoe leather sociology by my father, Milton J. Rosenberg, who was a professor of social psychology at the University of Chicago. And just to backtrack and set the stage a tiny bit, 1968, right? I'm 10 years old. The Yippies are in town for the Democratic National Convention, and they're pissed off too, right? So my father takes me down to Lincoln Park on the north side, where Jerry Rubin and all his Yippie friends are fomenting revolution. They're in their tents, you know, smoking weed and doing Lord knows what else. And I notice details, and that's part of what I like to do. I like to do storytelling, and that's part of my process too. I noticed a bunch of undercover Chicago cops sitting on the hood of their Dodge Polaris. And back in the day, it was always a Dodge Polaris, this big clunky sedan. And these guys are sitting there in their polyester slacks and their sharp collared shirts. And they're looking around at the crowd And I can see the terror in their eyes. They're thinking, you know, whoa, what are we going to do with this? Well, later that same night, things broke out into a big melee there. And then the next day, it turned out, was the day of that sort of historic conflagration in front of the Conrad Hilton, where protesters, you know, were beaten in what was later called a police riot. And that was the day that the protesters started chanting, "The whole world is watching." So I got to see kind of the seeds of that the night before because my father brought me along. So flash forward to the present day when I moved to Chicago and came back in the fall of 2020. As I said, I moved into Bridgeport, kind of the ancestral Irish political home of the city. But basically, I went deep into the South Side. So my mission, Charles, was that I wanted to talk particularly to Black people, families, individuals, and also to Latinos. And I wanted to hear their success stories. I consciously sought out what you might call Black conservatives or people who had shown some willingness to challenge the status quo. And so I did that. And, you know, I met some people, people like Daryl Smith in Englewood, Latasha and Ron Fields in Washington Heights, a young man named Jesse Mack, who worked for a charter school and had been educated at one during high school in East Englewood. I spoke to people in Roseland and Pullman. I went out to the West Side, to West Garfield Park to talk to a charter school founder. And, you know, I actually ended up interviewing people that I met on the street. So one of my best interviews was with a retired Chicago school teacher named Cynthia Simmons, who had a lot to say. I was walking down on the South Side around 75th and Vincennes, and I see this huge pink apparition, and it's a store called Nubian Nation. And I'm thinking, what is this? And there are cars pulling in and out of the parking lot. I go in, and it turns out, and this was interesting to me, it's a store that sells customized gear, sweatshirts, calendars, keychains, all of that for members of Black college fraternities and sororities. And there was a steady trade. There were cars pulling in and out, people coming in and buying all kinds of stuff. I went in the store and just kind of nosed around and ended up talking to one of the salespeople, who was this woman, Cynthia Simmons, who had a great deal to say because she had grown up in the Chatham neighborhood in the 1960s. And she remembered when it was a thriving neighborhood. And this turned out, of course, to be a big piece of the book, Neighborhood Economic Development, the current state of Black neighborhoods in the city versus the former state. You know, and there were thriving neighborhood shopping districts and, you know, thriving families and reasonably thriving public schools. In the 1960s and, you know, by the early 70s, everything had changed. There had been white flight. I got all kinds of vibrations and emanations by walking through Chicago in the year 2020. Yeah, a tall white guy walking through Black Chicago to meet with Black people in their homes and workplaces, but also interacting with Black people on the street. And one of the things I took away from it was there was actually a fond recollection among some of the old timers, like this retired school teacher, of the time there was a cusp, you know, in the early 70s before white flight had totally occurred, when neighborhoods like Roseland and Chatham were, you know, for a fleeting couple of years, they were actually integrated. And I heard Black people speaking about that wistfully.
Coming up, my final segment with Matt Rosenberg, journalist, writer, and author of What Next Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son. You're listening to The Charles Love Show on AM 560, The Answer.
The Charles Love Show continues on AM 560, The Answer. Here's Charles Love.
Welcome back. I've reached my final segment with Matt Rosenberg, author of What's Next Chicago. And we've been talking about Chicago, corruption, incompetence, crime, the education system, all these problems from the mind of someone who grew up in Chicago and knows Chicago well. And in the last segment, he was talking about the neighborhoods, the importance of the neighborhoods and the people he met and what he was drawing from their conversations. And he ended by talking about people he met that had a fond memory of what the neighborhoods were like before they got to where they are today. So here he talks about where we are now and the problems of gentrification, the current segregation of neighborhoods, and more stories from the neighborhood.
So that stays with me, you know, and it is an extremely segregated city in a way, always has been. And we all know that. But there's some kind of a germ there of an idea, you know, and then that kind of butts into fears and concerns about so-called gentrification, which you now see occurring on the West Side in formerly distressed neighborhoods where now development is occurring. Whites are moving in. And yes, you know, rents and property values are going up. I heard something from a Black woman named Vicki Reeder. This is after the book was published. And, you know, I've been back in Chicago basically since early September of 2021. I've just been back here doing more research, more writing and networking, frankly, about how to take this city back. Well, I met a Black woman from Englewood named Vicki Reeder, and it was really funny. She said, yeah, the West Side's coming up. These white people are taking pretty good care of it. She had no resentment because she also said to me, man, Englewood right now, I grew up there. It used to be great. I was raised by a village. She said there was a Miss Lula. There was a Miss Jenny. And if you messed around, they were going to whoop you. They would take you back to your mama who would whoop you. When your father came home, he would whoop you. She had like 8 siblings. They were all instilled with values of you must A, graduate high school, and then B, you're either going into public service or the military, or you are going to have some kind of a career. And that's it. There's no working around it. And all 9 children in that family, you know, went that route and things turned out well. But, you know, she grew up with that. But now she looks at Englewood and she said to me, man, look at this, man. No playgrounds, no kids laughing, no kids playing, having a good time. Empty lots, bare land, crime. It's just like a zone of devastation. And she contrasts that with what is happening, you know, where middle and upper income people are coming into formerly hard hit neighborhoods. And she's like, look, I can't speak against economic progress. We just need to get some of it down here too. And that is the trick and the challenge.
I'd like to thank Matt again for joining me and say that this is too much to talk about here. And we didn't even get to solutions like we typically do. So fortunately, I knew this would happen, and that's why the interview is done in a two-parter. So next week, we will have the rest of my conversation with Matt, where we talk about racism policies, Lori Lightfoot, and solutions to the problems that Chicago's facing. So please tune in for that next week. Also, subscribe and like the page. Check out the podcast, Cut the Bull, with myself, Shamika Michelle, and Wilfred Riley. And don't forget to pick up my latest book, Race Crazy, BLM 1619 and the Progressive Racism Movement. And as usual, thanks for listening. Talk to you next week.
could unlock more cash than you realize from your home's equity with a cash-out refinance today. In the last year, average home values have gone up nearly 20%. And with Rocket Mortgage, you could unlock thousands in less than 3 weeks. But you've got to act right now before rates go up. So when you're looking to unlock the cash in your home, Rocket can. Call 833-8-ROCKET today or go to rocketmortgage.com to get started. Rocket.
Rates current as of 12/12/21. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerActs.org. Number 3030. Call 800-490-1233 for disclosures and cost information.